The Science of Safety Online, brought to you by the Online Safety Exchange. I'm Martin Cocker, and this is Radio SOSA. All right, Justin Petch, and welcome to the Online Safety Exchange podcast, also known as Radio SOSO, the Science of Safety Online. Before we get to know you a little bit better, just drop you straight in. Just imagine that you get off this call with me and you get a call from the appropriate person from the President's Cabinet, and they say, Justin, I've heard you're a bit of an expert in online safety. I'm on my way to a meeting. I need a three-point plan. They always want three, but you might want to have a four-point or a five-point plan for online safety for America. You're an expert. Go.
Wow.
Do you have a five-point plan?
I would lead by saying we just need more support for education on these issues, whether it's in the schools or other community institutions, because there's a lot of talk in government and elsewhere about, you know, teaching kids how to be safe online. And I think to some extent, parents are doing the best they can and teachers are doing the best they can. But there's not a lot of support for actual, you know, formal education on these matters, because this is where they live. This is a big part of their lives. And so we need to recognize that and devote the time needed to actually give them the skills to be successful online. And that's beyond my sort of expertise in, you know, the harms of online, but just using technology wisely. And so I think the first thing is prioritize resources to educate youth and parents and others who try to help youth on these issues. I think it would be helpful to have someone in the, you know, upper echelon of government to spearhead these initiatives. We don't have, you know, an e-safety commissioner or, you know, a NetSafe or any of these sort of broad governmental or NGO entities to help lead efforts in this regard. So I think we're a little bit behind. It's hard, you know, in the U.S. we've got a lot of different states doing a lot of different things, but at least having somebody, you know, in government to channel evidence-based information to the states, the communities, the school districts, so that they know they're doing the right kind of things. But number one, Martin, I would just say invite me to the table and I'll have conversations with whoever will listen about how we can improve our ability to help young people be successful online. So that's the first step the first hurdle we have to jump over.
I think the Julie, safety commissioner, she talks about a seatbelt moment and the need for online safety to have its seatbelt moment. I'm not sure we haven't already had our seatbelt moment if you directly compare to the safety in automobiles sort of thing. But for you, what do you think would be the seatbelt moment? What do you think is that point of inflection, tipping point, to use Malcolm Gladwell's concept?
Yeah, it's hard to say because, like you suggest, I think we've had some moments where, I mean, certainly a lot of kids have gotten into a lot of trouble because of what they've done online in a number of different areas. And, you know, does it take more? Does it take more serious consequences? I mean, we've seen the worst of the worst, right? I mean, we've seen some kids end up in, you know, significant trouble because of these things. And we've certainly seen the fallout related to, you know, mental health concerns and screen time. And so there's a lot of focus on the concerns, even though we, you know, don't have a great handle on the extent of those concerns or whether the harms outweigh the benefits. But little concern, at least certainly from the governmental voices, has focused on solutions to these things. And so it's great to say, you know, there are concerns with young people spending too much time online, or there are some mental health consequences associated with you know, certain social media activities. Okay, so now what, right? And so we need to do something about that short of shutting down the internet, right? Because that's not a viable solution. It's not even realistic. It wasn't 20 years ago. It isn't now. So the metaphor I often use is, you know, there are a lot of kids that have trouble in school. They have behavioral issues, there's mental health issues, there's academic issues, and we certainly don't respond to those by, you know, pulling our kids out of school completely. right? We don't remove school. We don't shut down school. So what have we done in some schools? We've created, you know, avenues for them to be successful. Maybe there's more school psychologists, there's school counselors, there's school social workers, there's adults who have training in some of the issues that they're dealing with to help navigate those challenges. And the same should be true with online experiences and the World Wide Web, because it's a similarly important domain for young people. And so we need to sort of direct resources to kind of supplementing the resources that young people have to be successful there.
We should probably back up the truck a little bit and just explain why I'm talking to you at all as an expert in online safety, because you're a professor of criminal justice. So I think we talked about this years ago, but my understanding is you train people who are going into justice careers. So I assume that's into investigative type roles, maybe into the law, that sort of thing. And then at some point you formed the Cyberbully Research Center. And, you know, as people know, cyberbullying.org, the website. What's the sort of sequence of events? How did you go from young, enthusiastic criminologist to a world-leading expert on cyberbullying?
It's an interesting path. So I've always been interested in working with young people. And I work in the juvenile justice system. I worked with young people who had, you know, engaged in risky behaviors or, you know, delinquent behaviors here in the U.S., while I was an undergraduate student. And I assumed I would do that the rest of my life. I've always liked helping kids. I did it even when I was a teenager. I coached T-ball. And so I've always been interested in working with young people. I went to graduate school to get a master's degree with the intent on being like a youth caseworker, a juvenile probation officer, something where I could help young people who were, you know, having behavioral difficulties or in difficult situations. And in graduate school is where I met up with Samir Hinduja. And so basically the first day I arrived at Michigan State University for graduate school, I met up with him. And, you know, I was interested in kids and young people and bullying. I had, you know, experienced bullying when I was in middle school, and I had seen kind of the effects of it. And Samir was interested in technology and computer crime and high tech crime, you know, in these sort of emerging technological issues, and this was 99, 2000. And we shared a tiny office together, and we just started, you know, talking about our respective interests, you know, mine and kids, his and technology. And we started thinking about the ways that young people were using technology even back then, and some of the problems they could get into. And of course, as budding academics, the first thing we did was look into the research to see who was studying these things. And back in 99 and 2000, not very many people were. So we started looking into it. It started simply enough by just talking with kids and parents and teachers about what they were seeing and experiencing. And we did our first sort of formal pilot survey, I think, in 2002, where we just surveyed some young people online about their experiences with cyberbullying and some other things. And it really blossomed from there. So, yeah, my day job is, you know, I'm a criminology professor, and I do teach future police officers, lawyers, you know, students that'll maybe go into careers working with young people. But my research is always focused on technology and mostly the sort of negative, you know, the problems that young people can run into. But we do like to spend some time emphasizing the positive and the good things that technology has to offer. So I think I come at the problem of cyberbullying or other harms online from a unique perspective, in the sense that I do work with a lot of law enforcement officers and, you know, court officials who are generally pretty, pretty negative, pretty skeptical about technology and kids, and the harms outweigh the risk, I think, or the benefits, I think, in their minds. But I'm very neutral on it, honestly. My opinions are derived from the research that I do and the research that I see others do. And so, you know, it's not to be, you know, that technology is bad or a certain app is bad. Well, let's look at the research says and deduce from there. So Samir and I are both proponents of evidence-based decision-making, looking at the research and not getting too caught up in hyperbole or conventional wisdom. And I think our social science training prepared us for that. So it is interesting when you look at the, top 10, let's say, researchers in this field, at least in the US, they're in a variety of disciplines, whether it's psychology or communications. And it is a very interdisciplinary field in looking at sort of what young people are doing online. And so it's great because I get to have conversations with these folks, again, not only in the US, but certainly abroad, as you know. And they're similarly from broad perspectives, which I think allows us to look at these problems with a broader lens.
Yeah, so you've been researching in the online safety space for about 20 years. Which of all the research projects that you've undertaken, which one do you think is the most significant in terms of its impact on the way you understood, the online safety space?
Well, I'll take the easy answer to that question by saying the first, because we didn't know anything, right? And we had expectations or hypotheses. We even had, theories about how young people would even respond to the research we were doing. By that, I mean, we were among the first, certainly at Michigan State University where we were, to do online research. And it actually took us a while to get permission from sort of our research office to do it, because there's different consent issues when working with kids. So we had some open-ended questions on this survey, for example. Tell us about your most recent experience with cyberbullying. And we had no idea, right, what to expect. And we figured, because we're surveying young people, that we'd get very short answers, like it was terrible, or he was mean, or this is what happened. And back in those days, you had to kind of specify the width of, predict how many words you expected the person to see, right? Well, we drastically underestimated that. So let's say we set the text box to allow for 100 words, right? Well, we had some young people that wrote 1,000 words, okay? They told us their whole stories. And that was amazing for the research, right? Because we had these detailed, rich, colorful stories of what was happening, heartrending in many cases. And it really opened our eyes to the nature and extent of this problem. But it created months of work because basically all the different columns in that data set got messed up and we had to clean it up. So it was a good problem to have, but we learned very early on that young people had, these stories that they wanted to tell. Even the methodology in some of those early studies were very simple. They weren't, nationally representative samples or anything like that. So the last several studies we've done in the U.S. have been that way. We've done studies in, I think, 5 or 6 other countries as well, where we surveyed young people and in some cases their parents. So I like to look at that first one as being sort of the most impactful in terms of my thinking. But then I try not to put too much emphasis on any one study, either mine and Samir's or any other one. I'm not going to read a paper, even if it's the gold standard of methodology, and say, well, this answers all the questions that we have. I tend to look at the cumulative nature of the research and how this one builds on this other one. And this one might the results in this one might be a little bit different from this other one. But if you pull them together, then you can kind of see, you're starting to, it's like the metaphor of different pictures of the elephant, right? You have tiny different pictures of this, gray, and there's a tail. You start putting things together, and then you can start to see what's actually happening, I think, among youth. And I'll also finish that response by saying we do all this quantitative research and some qualitative research where we're asking young people to tell us in their own words, like in an online survey, about their experiences. But we learn just as much, if not more, from just talking with kids. So we travel the world, as you know, and much of what we do is presentations for young people or talking with teachers or workshops, assemblies. And I always take the opportunity to just have a chat, with kids about their favorite app, their favorite game, what they're seeing. And mentally, I compare what they're telling me with what we're seeing in the research just to make sure everything lines up, because you never really know. So I learned just as much from just sitting down and chatting with kids as I do in my formal research.
There seems to be a movement in two different directions where you've got regulators, especially thinking specifically about youth safety online, who are sort of taking this approach of a kind of a highly protective approach, kind of removing the harm, putting the parents in a position of control. So that seems to be the kind of regulator's thought on it at the moment. And then there's quite a few researchers who seem to be concerned that the only way, their feeling is the only way to really be successful is to have young people more participate more, not less, more in online safety. Do you think that's a fair reflection of the situation at the moment? And, you know, is there any kind of dissenting view amongst researchers about that?
Oh, there's a lot of dissent, I would say, among the researchers and among the regulators, because we just don't know. And anyone who will tell you this is correct and this is the right approach, you know, they're just not taking a full view of things, right? Because I think those two dichotomies are both flawed, right? And so we need to look at something more in the middle. And I'm sort of in favor of giving young people and their families the tools that they can use to make their online experiences positive. And, you know, you've got two young kids. And so what might work in your family might be different in my family. I've got a 13-year-old. And so not every 13-year-old is the same. And so to say that, even just the simple argument of when to give your child a phone, right? There's so much dissension. And then now there's a movement in the US, like don't give your kid a phone until, you know, they're 15 or until they're in high school. And why? Because it's a catchy sort of thing. I mean, what's the research behind that? And again, is it something about the physical device that you're concerned about? Or is it a particular app or the amount of hours they're on the device? All of those things can be handled. They can be dealt with. And I am in favor of giving parents a lot of control because, frankly, they know their kids best. And obviously, if parents are negligent or if they're not doing what they need to be doing to protect their kids and sort of help them deal with these situations, then perhaps government should step in. But again, I don't like the extremes of all or nothing. I feel like we need to give parents the right amount of tools. So I like the direction that a lot of apps are going, as controversial as it might be, of opening up access to their platforms to younger kids, right? In the US, you technically have to be 13 to be on a lot of these platforms. Well, you know, Meta and TikTok and, you know, Google, YouTube, all these platforms, all these companies are creating opportunities for younger kids to get involved with a lot of parental support, right? So the parents set up the account, they have a lot of controls in terms of, you know, who the child can interact with and commenting and viewing certain types of content. And that's where I think the utility is. And I don't think it takes government regulators to force that. I think the market is sort of driving that. But there, you know, there is that big tension between, especially here in the US, the free speech versus the regulation, and, you know, how kids get caught up in that. But every family's different, every situation is different. And so having a one size fits all kind of regulation, I just don't think there's any utility in that. There's got to be some flexibility.
I'm glad you mentioned the one size fits all, because that's one of my current bugbears about your Section 230, which is the sort of gate that just swings open or shut on responsibility. And it feels like it desperately needs some sort of updating. But, you know, I mean, it's easy to sit back and say it does. A little bit more difficult to actually define how you create that sort of granularity between responsible and not responsible. I mean, do you have a view on where Section 230 could go to make it more effective?
No, I mean, I'm with you. It's flawed without a doubt. It's outdated. You know, there's clearly problems with it. And the somewhat, I mean, I guess it's not random application or random arbitrary interpretation of it, because I guess, you know, those who are tasked with interpreting it have drawn a line in the sand. I mean, whether you agree with that or not, they've sort of, like you said, it's either yay or nay. And it just presumes there's no gray area when, of course, there is. So my take is, you know, I think I've written about this in the past. I tend to look at it from the same sort of obligation we give to parents in terms of protecting their kids. So for the most part, the government stays out of parents' ways, at least here in the US, stays out of their way in terms of parents can parent the way they want to parent, right? In terms of discipline, unless they cross a certain line, like a pretty, you know, pretty bad line in terms of physical abuse or neglect, those kinds of things. So I think we all could probably agree on, you know, this certain line that when government needs to get involved and whether it's regulating websites. I mean, I think we'd all agree that we don't want kids looking at pornographic websites to the extent that, you know, they have access, that kind of thing, I think we can all agree upon. But then in terms of sort of responsibility of platforms or companies to make their apps and games safe, to keep them, you know, for protecting kids, for keeping, you know, misinformation off the platforms. Here again, I look at whether the app is being sort of deliberately indifferent to negativity on their platforms. So are they actually making efforts to stop spam, to stop pornography, to some effort to try to create avenues for kids to use these platforms in the certain paths that are appropriate for their age, right? Because I don't think anybody would think it's a good idea to, for example, and I've used this metaphor before, to drop a teenager off in Washington, D.C. and just say, have a good look around and, you know, see how things go. Because Washington, D.C. is a very, you know, interesting city. There's a lot of important monuments and historical buildings and museums and things. But there's also a lot of crime. There's also a lot of drugs. There's also a lot of negativity there. So having a guide who can walk you to these good places and maybe some walls to keep you away from the bad neighborhoods. And so I think there needs to be some obligation on the part of these companies. And like I said earlier, I think many companies are responding to the market demand for that. You know, whether they'll move fast enough for regulators is a different thing. But frankly, for me as a parent, as somebody who studies these things, yeah, I'm going to make sure that my child, I'm going to encourage my child to spend more time on the apps, the games, the environments that have more tools for him and, you know, us as a family to protect his experiences on there. So if the app is completely hands off and just lets 13-year-olds roam wherever they want to roam, I'm kind of concerned about that as well. It's also a problem related to this. Even just that age, like who says when you turn 13, all of a sudden you're mature enough to be using TikTok responsibly. And when you're 12, you're not. I mean, this is just, it's just a farce. I mean, I know they need to draw the line somewhere, but is 13 the right line, or is it 10, or is it 15? These are debates that need to be informed by, you know, developmental psychology, adolescent development, but also need to allow for some flexibility because my kid might not be ready for these things, whereas yours are.
Yeah, well, they're definitely not at the moment.
Not at the moment, but it'll be interesting with your two kids, to see if there's differences, you know, in one versus the other, right? And whether the older one can handle more responsibility than the younger one. So it's just, it is interesting how there's variation within families.
There absolutely will be with those two. A couple of things about the regulation. I mean, firstly, one of the issues with regulation, I think it kind of came out in your answer there about, you know, which apps you would promote to your children. The regulators are regulating the best behaved apps already. So the big players are the ones who are the targets of regulation because they're the big players, but they're also the ones making the heaviest investment in safety. So in actual fact, the worst of the internet is barely touched by regulation, whereas the best of the internet is heavily hit by regulation. So I don't know if there's a question in that really, other than to say that we see that all around the world, that actually we're all regulating the life out of Meta and TikTok. And mm-hmm. The other thing you mentioned, and again, it's not really a question, it's probably just a follow-up, but the idea of 13 and then that applying universally across everything, that's part of the issue of online safety. Twitter is not, TikTok is not, Instagram, it's not YouTube, but we put them all into one bucket. And again, that comes back to that idea of you either are or you aren't under the law. You're a publisher or you are not. And these are all very different sorts of businesses. And that doesn't feel like regulation has really created a category for them. But one of the things that you did try to do is obviously you got frustrated with progress in the sexting, you know, non-consensual image-based abuse kind of space, and you drafted up a piece of, I guess, a piece of regulation and put that out. Can you just talk to me about the process of actually what drove you to create that and how that's been received, I guess?
Sure. Yeah. So this stems from Samir and I have been interested in the problems of sexting for a long time. We've collected data on it. We know it's an issue. We know that some young people get themselves into some significant trouble because of their experiences with sexting, but many don't. Probably most don't. And so we, as parents, you know, we're both parents. So Samir and I are both parents, and as people who work with parents and you know, young people, we agree that, you know, it's probably not a good idea for young people under let's say 18 to be sexting. Not all researchers agree with this, by the way. There is some debate that, you know, some research suggests, well, it's just a healthy relationship kind of thing, or it can be. But we're of the perspective that it's probably not a good thing, particularly in the U.S., because of sort of outdated laws that treat any explicit image of a minor as child pornography. And the laws, as we've talked about before, are very indiscriminate. They're a very blunt tool. And so while child pornography laws here in the U.S. were designed to protect kids from, you know, predators and those who would abuse them, they're being applied in some cases, thankfully somewhat rare cases, but definitely in enough cases to notice, against the children themselves when they create and voluntarily or consensually share those images. So a couple of things. We wrote a paper in the Journal of Adolescent Health a few years ago, somewhat controversial, advocating the need for teaching safe sexting. And we didn't specifically say that it should be done by schools, although that's one approach. But, you know, this is something we'd been kicking around for years. Samir and I would talk about it, and we didn't have the guts to really write anything about it until just a few years ago. And we thought, well, you know, this is something we need to have a conversation about. So whether you agree with us or disagree with us, there needs to be an academic conversation about teaching safe sexting, which means trying to mitigate the worst of the harms, right? And the worst harms in the U.S. are essentially centered around those images being shared beyond their original, you know, desired recipient. So yeah, if two consenting individuals are sharing images with each other and they never go beyond that, there's very little risk, right? But when they get shared with others or the police get involved, that's when, particularly among kids, there could be significant long-term consequences. And so our essay in that journal was basically outlining some ways to make sexting safer. Just like sex, it can never be 100% safe, right? But it's a harm reduction model. And as you can imagine, that paper got a lot of feedback regarding that paper, and it was very bimodal. It was people either loved it or they hated it, and they told us why. And I every single email and phone call I got, I just responded by saying, thank you. Now we're finally having this conversation. When Samir and I sat down to write that paper, we thought we were innovative. Oh, we're the first people to ever, you know, talk about this. But of course we weren't. There were people in Europe, especially, and Australia and New Zealand, who were thinking about these things in this way much earlier than we were. So we relied on some of that research as well. But this led into what you're talking about, which was a couple summers ago. I basically, well, we've done this now for a few years, for probably 8 to 10 years, longer for cyberbullying, but for sexting, I think it's been about 10 years, where we look at sexting legislation, laws across the United States. And surprisingly few states have specific sexting laws. And those that do, none of them are very good. Okay, so this is something that I do, is I look up the law. I basically write down, sort of summarize the legislation on what it addresses, you know, sending, receiving, felonies, misdemeanors, all this kind of stuff. And so I'd done this for, you know, 3 or 4 different times every few years. And this most recent time I did it, I thought, you know, I've seen enough of these laws, especially enough bad laws, that I kind of know what a good law would look like. And it would provide more flexibility. And some states have decent laws. But the problem is, we need to give prosecutors and law enforcement officers, you know, the flexibility to handle the most egregious forms of sexting within, you know, the criminal courts, because that's where that belongs. And when I mean egregious, I mean, you know, threats regarding sending images, blatantly sharing with others without the person's permission. But they also need to give these authorities the tools to decide that, look, this was a consensual activity among, you know, these individuals. No one is harmed by this. So let's deal with it. Let's educate them a little bit about the risks that could occur. So the laws are tricky in the sense that they don't provide a lot of flexibility typically. But I think that's what's necessary. And the problem is the states that do not have a specific sexting law would often default to our federal law, which is basically the child pornography. So we need to give authorities more tools. And that's kind of my approach, is to give them some of those more, some additional tools. And, you know, I've gotten some feedback about that. I haven't been contacted by a legislator saying, let's do it. I have had several lawyers or I think legislative aides say, well, here's a problem, or maybe you should include this, or have you thought about this? But I'm happy to hand my phone number out to any legislator who wants to talk about it. I don't think it's very politically popular right now to be taking on this issue, but we do need to give more clarity to young people about these behaviors, and simply threatening them with, you know, being charged as a child pornographer if they share these images, it's not helpful. Right. So we want to limit the behaviors. Fine. We want them to be safe. We want to minimize the worst of the consequences. And in some cases, when we are talking about predatory behavior, those individuals need to be held accountable 100%. So flexibility is definitely needed.
I guess that's the thing about the model sexting law that you've proposed, as a sort of a graduated series of responses. And I actually think that you can say it's a model sexting law with a graduated set of responses to, you know, manage every level of offending, and you've got a nice little political statement. But politicians do like things even simpler, don't they?
Yes.
Which is, if somebody sexts, we will punish them, and so they tend to go for those. You would have seen recently the Surgeon General of the US put out a paper about youth and social media, talking about a plan, and it had sort of ideas for different sectors on how they could respond. Just at the very kind of under the base layer of that paper, there is a attempt to talk about a link between a decline in youth mental health and a rise in social media. How do you feel about that being, I use the term correlated, but I'm using it as loosely as possible?
Yeah, you know, this is a tough one. I think most of the data, most of the actual good research I've seen, it's a pretty tenuous link. There's no doubt a good number of young people who are struggling with their mental health. And there's also no doubt that some of those mental health challenges are exacerbated by, you know, their online experiences. It's hard to say, though, it's hard to extend that to all kids, or, you know, all kids of a certain age, or even all kids who have mental health issues, because I have seen some young people benefit from their online communities and support groups. And so while there is some correlative, you know, correlations there, it's really hard to say. I haven't seen any research that says more use of social media causes young people to have, you know, worse mental health outcomes in terms of a, you know, really rigorous study. I haven't seen that. I think there's research being done now that will hopefully shed some light on that. There are certainly people shouting from the rooftops that, and there's no doubt that mental health challenges have increased in the last 10 or 15 years, you know, at the same time that social media use, smartphone use, all these technology issues have increased. But that may just be a correlation. And, you know, some of the research I see that looks into those correlations, you know, suggests that might be a really small effect. And the other problem I have with that is it ignores all the very positive youth outcomes we're seeing now. At least in the U.S., it's like juvenile crime is probably the lowest it's been in 40 years, right? Teens are having less sex, less often, less early. Teen pregnancy is down. All these really positive indicators. And are we going to blame technology for those as well? And maybe there's a role there. I don't know. So I think we're still in the middle, probably not even at the middle, in the early stages of understanding this relationship. Now, again, there's no doubt for some kids, the social media is a problem. And to me, parents need to step in. Parents need to sort of observe how much social media, how much screen time, how much gaming their kids are doing. And if it is a problem, they need to pull that back. They need to dial that back. And whether that's, you know, restricting the number of hours or the types of games or, you know, getting them resources, you know. So I think there there's probably something there, but I don't know, we know enough yet to know how to address that problem. Like I said, you know, I hated going to school when I was in middle school. It created a lot of anxiety for me, and you could argue mental health issues. And are we just going to, you know, pull me out of school? And back then, of course, you couldn't do that. Now there maybe are some options for online school and things, but we need to figure out what exactly it is about the social media that is potentially problematic for this subset of kids. I can't imagine it's just simply a number of hours, for example, and it certainly can't be the apps that they're visiting, that this app is worse than that app. I just have a hard time seeing that. My suspicion, my hypothesis is there are some kids that are really struggling for other reasons, family reasons, social reasons, and they're going online. And in some cases, those problems are exacerbated because of, you know, the communities they're involved in there. Could we find them a better community? Could we find them a supportive community? Because I know there are some kids that do find a lot of support from their online experiences. So this generalization that social media, whatever that is, I don't know, is TikTok social media? Is Snapchat social media? I don't know if you throw all these in. Is that social media is causing young people to have mental health issues? I don't know. I think we need to be more precise with our relationships and consequences.
Yeah, I've been positing a theory to anybody that would listen, which is a pretty small group, let's be honest, but anybody who would listen, that there may actually turn out to be a fairly direct relationship between social media and the rise of mental health challenges. And it may simply be that social media is like a window to the reality of the world. And so we're exposing young people to these quite challenging concepts in a way that, you know, a generation back, they weren't being. And so that would then have an effect on mental health because, you know, suddenly young people are grappling with these issues and being made aware of, you know, just honestly how messed up aspects of the world are. That's not to say that social media or technology is to blame, other than the fact that it provided them with this information and therefore created this kind of burden. But I also, you know, I hear what you're saying, that could very well be, you know, kind of six or seven interrelated factors, what platform they're on, who they're talking to, what their experience is coming into that. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, can take quite a long time to ascertain from research, even if you realize there's a correlation. So I think one of the things the Surgeon General recommended was more research. So, you know, hopefully that'll lead to opportunities and actually get into a bit more depth on it.
Well, and if you're right, I would say this. Certainly, that's not the fault. It's not TikTok's fault any more than Snapchat's fault any more than Meta's fault. You know what I mean? So, I can see your theory that, look, kids are being exposed to climate issues and war and all of these kind of adult things. It's not like when, you know, I was growing up and, you know, the sitcoms all had, you know, nice, happy endings. Everything got resolved. That's not the real world. And so perhaps these young people are being exposed to these big issues at an earlier stage than, you know, what's developmentally appropriate.
Yeah, I just think there's some pretty heavy concepts for mm-hmm. us all to deal with. And, you know, if you have to try to deal with that concept at the wrong time, you know, it could have effects on mental health. But I also think that the reality is we're probably not as expert on mental health today as we would like to think we are.
I think that's right.
There's probably some things we don't understand about why, you know, certain things affect some people more than others. So into the metaverse. Have you, we were all talking about metaverse about, I don't know, a year ago, and now it's all AI, but just the metaverse is still bubbling away, that sort of virtual reality, augmented reality world. Do you think that those things, augmented reality, virtual reality, really bring anything new into the online safety space? Are they genuinely going to be transformative, or more of the same?
Well, I'm very bad at predicting the future, I can tell you that much, because you know, even certain apps that I thought were nothing and become super popular. So I've been wrong about the metaverse for a while, because, you know, variations of, you know, virtual reality have been around for a long time. You know, certainly the company Meta is going all in on the metaverse, and like you said, they might be it might be kind of sideswiped by AI and all these different things. But will it be anything different from a, you know, from our perspective on cyberbullying, there's not a lot new. I know it's more immersive, right? So potentially the emotions or the consequences could be even more dramatic because of the immersive nature of that environment. We have collected some data on cyberbullying within the metaverse, and we got data last week, and I haven't looked at it yet, but it's probably the first, I'm sure other people are doing it too. Every time I think we're being innovative, we really aren't. But we are looking at the extent of cyberbullying in some of these virtual reality environments, whether it is more consequential for those participants. I think, I'm a little worried that even though we have a fairly large sample of young people, not as many kids are still using it. I mean, certainly a lot of young people are using, the different headsets, but I don't know if it's enough to really gather. We'll see. I mean, the jury's still out, but we've collected some preliminary data. And so I guess we have to have this conversation in 5 or 10 years to see, how it pans out. But I'm not sure. I mean, you remember Second Life back in the day? This was probably 10 years ago. There was an app or a game or an environment called Second Life where it was sort of virtual reality. I mean, you weren't in it like you are now, but there have been these types of environments that are trying to be more immersive. And so the short answer is we'll see. We just don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you're down the track anyway in terms of capturing the data. So
we're trying.
Yeah, that's right. We'll have a look. One of the big debates playing out in the UK is around the use of end-to-end encryption. This is a kind of a debate between child safety, I guess, and privacy, but it's very much law enforcement who's pushing one side of that. So I assume it's something that you sort of keep an eye on. What do you think about that debate? Where do you think things are going to land, and what do you think is going to be the effect of that?
Again, I have no idea. I just had a debate with somebody about this not long ago. I'm trying to think the context and where we were discussing it, but I mean, I see both sides, right? I can see the benefits in terms of privacy of, the end-to-end encryption, but I also see the concerns from law enforcement or others in trying to track down the bad actors. So whether there can be this encryption that can only be sort of interrupted or identifying if you break the law. So I've had similar conversations with people about, quote, anonymous apps, right? It's a little bit easier with anonymous apps because there's been a similar debate with anonymous apps. And at least with anonymous apps, we can say that we all know that they're not truly anonymous. And so my argument for them over the past 10 years or whatever has been, essentially the app is willing to provide some measure of anonymity as long as you follow the rules, right? As long as you're not violating the conditions of the company and you're not being a bad actor and you're not, threatening people. And if you break the rules of the community, then you lose this expectation of privacy. And I think there needs to be some variation of that with end-to-end encryption, where as long as you're not breaking the law, then your privacy, is fine or should be withheld or should be upheld. But as soon as you break the law, then maybe there needs to be some authorities that can have access to it. Of course, the privacy people aren't going to like that answer because, the government is the law and they'll just go in whenever they want and, dig around. But again, I can see both sides of it. So there needs to be kind of a happy medium. There needs to be a compromise where, people should have the ability to be private online if they want or have an anonymous presence online if they want, because, maybe they're whistleblowing concerns within the government or whatever. But as soon as they kind of violate some standard, then I think there needs to be a way to identify, who that person is to hold them accountable. And maybe that's just part of my sort of criminology background. But we need to have some community standards that can be maintained in these environments. Otherwise, all hell's going to break loose and it's going to become like Twitter.
Like Twitter, the new standard for all hell being broken loose. It does appear that way, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the Twitter thing has been interesting, hasn't it? You watch the Twitter takeover and changes. What do you make of it? What's your view on what's happened there?
Well, I can tell you I'm not spending as much time on Twitter as I once did. And I used to defend Twitter, and to some extent I still do, only because you do have some controls about the kind of content you're exposed to, right? So Like when people would complain about Twitter being a cesspool, even 3, 4, 5 years ago, I would say, well, who are you following? Right? Who's following you? What kind of exchanges are you getting into? Because if I'm just following these 50 people that I know and respect, that's the content you're going to get. Right? Now, if you start, if those, same thing with Facebook or any other people that complain about Facebook, well, who are you following? Similarly, with even with TikTok and all these middle-aged men saying, well, TikTok is just a bunch of, you know, tweens doing these silly dances. The first thing I want to say is, when was the last time you were on TikTok? And if they do say, oh, I'm on TikTok all the time, and I say, well, then the algorithm seems to think that you want those 12-year-old tweens doing those dances, because the TikTok algorithm is exceptionally good at figuring out the kinds of content you like to see. So if you're using TikTok and you're telling me all you're seeing is these, you know, bad things or whatever, then that's what it's going to show you. So yeah, I think the Twitter's been kind of disappointing. I kind of lost a little bit of, I didn't spend as much time on Twitter in the last few years, even just because there's so much noise, right? You follow so many people follow you that, you know, if I post something that I think is super interesting and 3 people like it, and maybe only 10 people saw it, I mean, that's a problem, right? And I think it's gotten worse. And certainly there's a perception problem. Like you said, the sort of principle of free speech I can get behind until that speech is harassing in nature, threatening in nature, or violates some other, you know, community standard. And, you know, we can get into the debate about whether the government should regulate the speech on Twitter. But remember, it's a private company. They can allow whatever they want. If they want to be the community square that allows shouting and swearing and lying, then that's completely up to Elon and his minions.
Yeah, and I think that's probably part of the issue with Twitter, isn't it? It on the one hand, it's a valid kind of model to create a more free speech environment. But if you gut all the resources, then you're not really testing that model because you don't have the ability to actually properly manage it. I am doing some work on transparency. I don't know if you ever thought much about the transparency reporting of the big tech platforms. What do you think of the current state of transparency reporting? What would you like to see them do more of? That's probably the question. What would you like to see big tech do more of when it comes to transparency?
Well, yeah, I mean, more transparency is better. That's all I can say. And without getting into too many details, you know, Samir and I have worked with a number of, you know, big tech companies, and some of that work has been very positive. Most of that work has been very positive, and it's helping these platforms do better in terms of safety and youth protection. But not a lot of that work is public. You know, we have non-disclosure agreements. We can't talk specifically about, in some of these cases, who we work with and what we talk about. And so in this case, the example I'm trying to get to is they could be more transparent or more forthcoming about the positive things they're doing, right? To let the public know that here are the ways that we're improving these platforms for young people or for parents. And so I think it's a marketing problem, frankly. And so the more they can share what they're doing positively, I think that perhaps they could create a better public opinion about these companies. But if there are problems that are identified, either through, you know, research or whatever, test cases, government, they need to acknowledge certain problems and then try to discuss what they're doing to minimize those. So I think it's very important, especially for the big tech companies. I think you were spot on about the idea that we're, you know, regulating these, you know, big companies more than any other company. And it is, you know, frankly, it's unfair how much attention gets directed towards the big 3 or 4, but they are the leaders in the space. And so they have the resources to deal with it, and they need to be leaders. And in many cases, they are. But I don't think the general public fully understands that. And so if there are issues, I think they need to be forthcoming about what those are and, you know, what they're doing to address them. But even, you know, it can be hard for the public, but even trying to explain the challenges in addressing these issues. Like so many people would just say, well, let's just work towards age verification. If we knew that everybody was 13, then it'd be fine. Well, that, as you know, that's a super complicated problem that's not easy to solve. And so I think some companies, certainly some people in this space have tried to explain it and some of the challenges, but your run-of-the-mill parent or teacher or even police officer doesn't spend the time to think about it. They just think, well, this is technology, you can do anything, right? Or, and I've caught myself saying this before, this is Google, they could do whatever they want. Or, you know, this is Apple, they can do whatever they want. If they want a phone that, you know, can do this and that, they could just invent it. But some of these problems are a lot harder to solve than that. But I also know that many of these companies have some of the smartest people in the world working in them. So I can imagine they're working on some of these issues, but they need to be more transparent, of course.
Well, you talk about being notoriously inaccurate in your future predictions. I also publish some of mine, so you can confirm how bad my predictions
nice.
Have been. But if you just don't set a time frame on your predictions when it comes to technology, you'll
ooh,
be fine.
Maybe eventually. Yeah,
that's right. The phone will do this, the thing will do that. All right, Justin Petchen, thank you very much for joining me on the podcast. Really appreciated your comments. How are you going with your photography? Those are your photographs on the wall behind you, I take it. Are you
they
still
are.
Getting out and getting them, capturing them?
Yeah, not as much as I would want to because I've been so busy with things. And I have taken a few photographs. It is my sort of release from, you know, staring at a computer and doing data and stuff. I just like to be outside in the nature and just experiencing it. So that is, you know, one thing I really enjoy doing. So yeah, none of these pictures behind me were taken in the last like 3 or 4 years. So nothing wall hanging worthy, but a couple of really nice experiences. And Frank, there's been a couple of cases where I've been outside and seen some really amazing, you know, Mother Nature type things where I wished I had my camera. But I used to have really bad FOMO about that. Now I just sort of like take in the experience, whether it's a nice sunset or sunrise, I'll just experience it. And because most of my photography, the things I really like are the kind of the ephemeral things that aren't going to happen again, like a sunrise or a sunset or the Northern Lights, Aurora Borealis, or I guess where you are, maybe the Southern Lights, if you can see them. But so, yeah, thanks. It's definitely my one way, my one avenue of sort of artistic release. It stretches different parts of my brain. So, yeah.